We'll call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this May 2nd, 2005. Apologize for the delay, but interesting times on the horizon today. We will open the work session on House Bill 2065. This is a bill that revises provisions relating to speech pathologists and audiologists. These are work sessions. So, John McCulley and whoever else come forward with this book. Pamela, can we lower the screen there, please?
Lower it or erase it?
Lower the screen. There's no screen on there.
Oh, I see.
Create the screen.
Create, thank you.
There you go.
All right. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I realize you're in work session, so I'm here just to describe the amendments. John McCulley, representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association. You had a hearing on this bill in late February. It's a bill that was introduced at the request of the Board of Examiners for Speech Language Pathology and Audiology, and our organization is the professional interest group that is regulated by that board. The bill primarily makes technical changes in their law, although there were questions raised at the hearing. A group of us met after the hearing, and that group included the Oregon School Boards Association, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, Department of Education. We developed some changes to the bill, passed those by Teacher Standards Practices and Commission, and I think we have before you the consensus amendments to House Bill 2065. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll just briefly describe those, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. The first amendment to the bill, you'll see on page 3 of the bill, where the amendment would allow a stipend to be paid to students who are doing a practicum at a work location. The current law prohibits any compensation to students. In today's world, there are students who are finishing their graduate studies. They are doing this clinical training on site. And in many cases, the school district would like to reimburse them for their expenses. This would allow them to do that. It's a recruitment tool that says, if you do your training here, we would like you to come when you've graduated, come work for us. There is a shortage of speech-language pathologists in the state. There's intense competition, and this allows a way for people to assist students with their expenses in hopes that they will continue to work in an area, primarily rural areas. The next major change in the bill you'll find on pages 5 and 6. There were some concerns raised at the hearing about the new requirement for the doctorate-level person in audiology who could be the only person who could be licensed as an audiologist in the state. And I think Representative Butler was raising the questions, what about a master's-level person who comes to Oregon and wants to be licensed? To clarify that, the recommendation is to delete Section 7 and the corresponding Section 25 in the bill. Those were the two sections that relate to that issue. It will not affect the board's ability to have high licensing standards, but it does clarify the questions I think Representative Butler had raised. Finally, on page 10 in the bill, this is the section of the bill related to how a speech-language pathology assistant is supervised. The original language in the bill said that assistant had to be supervised by a licensed speech-language pathologist.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What bill section are you talking about?
I'm sorry. Page 10.
Well, I've got the hand and growth that makes okay.
It would be section 15.
Thank you.
Subsection 5. In many cases, there is not a licensed speech-language pathologist available to provide the supervision for the assistant. So the language that you see here would allow the Board of Examiners of Speech-Language Pathology and Audiology to work with TSPC to allow a licensed teacher who has a specialty in providing speech services, allow that licensed teacher to provide the supervision. And this would answer the concerns that both Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and Oregon School Boards Association had with the bill. And finally, Mr. Chair, the bill does add an emergency clause to allow the Board of Examiners to adopt these rules so that they could be in place as quickly as possible. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Questions? I think this is a good job. Sounds to me like everybody had an opportunity to participate in the final product. Sounds like it's ready to go. Anything else? Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Sir, one question. The Oregon Academy of Audiologists were at the table as well, John.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's correct. We shared these amendments with the Oregon Academy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks very much. With that, we're in work session. I'll entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2065 to be appended.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2065. Just a moment, please. Okay. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments, Dash 1 amendments, are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2065 to the Committee on Ways and Means by subsequent referral, by previous motion to refer to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2065 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Abstain.
Off the floor.
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Gina?
Aye.
Representative
Butler?
Aye.
Chair
Dalko?
Chair votes aye. Representative Anderson, are you ready to vote on this bill?
Aye.
Representative Anderson votes aye. It's a good bill, Representative Anderson. It's going Ways and Means anyway. Okay, House Bill 2065, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. We will close the work session on House Bill 2065. Let's see what we'll do here. Open a work session on House Bill 2202.
Do you have those amendments yet?
Just got them,
oh,
sir. In fact, I believe
Jean Lasseter, would you come forward?
Yeah, has hopefully she's had a chance before I was tardy, Mr. Chair.
Do this somewhere.
So, Jean, if you could introduce yourself and answer a couple of questions for me, that'd be great. Have you seen these Dash 1 amendments, the final ones?
Yes, Chair Dalto, members of the committee, my name's Jean Lasseter. I live and work here in Salem, and I'm here representing the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. And I just had a chance to read these amendments, and I believe they're consistent with and true to the objectives that we outlined in our previous hearing on this bill.
Okay. Jean, describe to me the process for which you met with stakeholders and interested parties to make sure that everybody was in agreement on this bill.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, the process that we followed is we had an original hearing for House Bill 2202, and it was decided by the committee that we needed to address some particular concerns regarding the policy implementation that was actually inherent in the language of the original bill. So in light of that, we met with Representative Boone and Representative Butler, and by we, I mean myself and Galen Phipps, who is the chair of the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition, and Randy Franke. And we met with Representative Butler, and We had a good, what I regard as a good conversation about how this bill addresses the needs of these youth with that, and the importance of allowing a two-way process between communities and the state organization in order to address the needs of these youth. And in light of that conversation, Mickey Lansing, the executive director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, convene the Partners for Children and Families, which include all of the organizations that are listed in the amendment, and basically she asked them, is this a population that you feel you as a group wish to address the needs of, and are you willing to do this? And they said yes. So what happened after that is that we drafted this amendment and brought it to Legislative Council, and here we are.
Okay, great. Colleagues, just take a moment to look at the amendment, if you will.
I just had one question.
Yes, sir.
I did not have a chance to visit with Mickey Lansing relative to these amendments, obviously. Has she seen, as the director of the Commission of Children and Families, had an opportunity to see these and express any concern about resources available to study and to make recommendations and to ensure integration of services, recommending policies and services that specifically address the needs and responsibilities of parents and their own homeless youth?
Gene, you worked with Mickey, right?
Yes, Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, members of the committee, Mickey Lansing has seen the amended language, she was fully involved in the conversation and the adjustments that were made and that process.
Has she seen these final amendments?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Not at this time.
Representative Butler, is that what you're driving at?
That plus the budget issues, because there's a process of reviewing existing state statutes and laws required here on page 2, paragraph E, maybe section 2, and normally there's some fiscal issues related to that. I just wondered if she had an opportunity to take a look at that with regard to the other existing statutes that she'll have to be reviewing as a result of any other changes.
All right. I want to move this bill out today, so here's what we're going to do. We'll close this work session, and then we'll come back to it in a few minutes. What I'd like you to do, Gene, is to get Mickey on the phone. Backseat's over here. Or is Mickey here?
She should be. She said she was
coming.
Find
Mickey.
Today.
Give her a copy of these amendments, and let staff know when you're ready.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, can we recess the work session, or do we have to close and open again?
Close and open.
Okay. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2202. We will open a work session on 2266. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2266 had a public hearing on March 4th. At that time, we heard from Legislative Council on the background of this bill. The bill clarifies that the Department of Human Services, or Area Aging on Aging, investigating a report of abuse on a long-term care facility, is authorized to photograph a resident or cause to have a resident photographed during an abuse investigation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, current statute identifies an investigating division. This bill is taking that language out and authorizing the Department of Human Services to be that department. This was part of the reorganization efforts back in 2001-2002. This statute got overlooked with that revising language. This is loosely quoted housekeeping. Unquote.
Right.
Chair.
Yes.
Sandy, it looks like it, or the area agency on aging.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's also not just the Department of Human Services, correct?
I'm sorry.
No, you're right.
Yes.
Okay.
But these are functions that both DHS and the areas of aging are already doing.
Great.
They've assumed that.
The AAAs do some contract work for the Department of Human Services in this area.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no revenue impact nor fiscal impact.
Nor objection, colleagues. So with that, I'll entertain a motion to send this to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2266 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative
Dumas? Aye.
Representative
Tomei? Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Dalton?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2266, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Butler?
I move that we put the House Bill 2266 on the House consent calendar.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2266 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Excuse me. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, House Bill 2266 is ordered placed on a consent calendar. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2266. We will, oh boy, open a work session. Mickey is here. Okay, well, we'll do one bill first. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2706. Representative Greenlick? We're ready to go on this bill?
Yep, I think we're ready to go. I think all the objections have been taken care of. I think so. At least all the serious objection. There's always some angst about it, but.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to point out that we have gotten approval to resend the referral to Judiciary Committee.
Okay. Representative Hansen, we'll get to your bill next. Thanks. Colleagues, this is a good bill. You'll recall this is a bill that helps provide information to prevent the transmission of HIV from mother to child in pregnancy. This refines the process for the consent to those examinations. We heard testimony that there are about two to three excuse me, children born every year in Oregon with HIV that was transmitted through the pregnancy, and the idea is to get this information as part of the prenatal care so that we can avoid the transmission. It is evidently preventable, and a lot of tragedy and heartache and the cost for folks if the children do have HIV transmitted. So there was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, excuse me, to the House Committee on Judiciary. We had that rescinded. So with that, Representative Greenlick.
The one issue that still is an angst is the question of what is good, what is the proper medical practice in informed consent. I believe good medical practice and informed consent is that you not only get consent on the blood draw, but you tell everybody specifically what's going on. Part of the agreement on this was that when I do a floor speech on this, I will put that on the record and also suggest that if it turns out not to be happening in a proper way, that the public health authority, whatever it's called nowadays, should take that up by rule rather than by statute, and I will do that. In the floor speech.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Greenlight.
Chair, just a quick question to staff. Bruce Bishop had indicated previously from the Hospital Administration Association that there may be amendments needed to accomplish this. Were those addressed? Were those concerns addressed?
Yeah, Bruce is nodding yes back there, and okay. I think the statement I just made will help that.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, with that, I'd move 2706 to the floor with the due pass amendment, due pass recommendation.
With the rescind.
Yeah, and you've already worked with the rescission, so yes, first that we rescind the referral, the subsequent referral to the Judiciary, secondly, move it to the House with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2706 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Judiciary be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Anderson? Aye. Representative Boone? Aye. Representative Cameron? Aye. Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Dalton?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2706, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Greenlick will carry this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Great job. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2706. And Let's see. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2351. Representative Hansen, would you come forward, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2351 was scheduled last week, and at that time, it had a hand-engrossed version and copies of the dash one and the dash twos. For Representative Hansen's benefit, the dash two amendment is just including a physician assistant in the reporting requirement.
Thank you very much. Representative Hansen, I'm just now seeing these amendments on this bill, and I wanted to have you walk us through the amendments that you've made to the bill. I don't want to work it out today. I want to first understand the amendments and have you explain it to me, and then we will make another appointment available after that. Thank you. With that, welcome.
Thank you. And I'll be discussing both 2351-1 and the dash 2s. And
can I have you introduce yourself for the record?
Gary Hansen, State Representative from House District 44.
Thank you.
Chairman Daldo, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to introduce the minor new amendments to 2351. Legislative Counsel Holly Robinson, who drafted this bill, is in her office this morning and would be available if the chairman wishes to answer questions on the bill. You have all seen copies of Gabrielle Ferreira Rhodes' testimony from January 30th, and Senator Westland joins me in sponsoring this legislation. The amendments address concerns from Attorney Bruce Bishop regarding representing the Oregon Hospital Associations and Health Systems, OAHHS, which I'll refer to as hospitals. Hospitals assert this bill is unnecessary because the member hospitals already have a policy against the conduct covered by the bill. The problem is that those internal hospital policies do not require hospitals to report the abuse to law enforcement officials or DHS. They also assert that because this bill uses some language of other existing state laws that protect abuse of the mentally ill and long-term clients, those laws may somehow be weakened by this bill. That's why we have added the amendment inserting at the start of Section 2, okay, the quote, except as otherwise provided by state law, to cover that objection. That's on line 7 of the proposed amendments. The overwhelming majority of patients suffering abuse will insist on it being reported. Their third objection was that certain public and private individuals such as psychiatrists should not be required to report privileged information. The overwhelming majority of patients suffering abuse will insist on it being reported. This section that we refer here is to protect the sexual assault victim's right to make his or her own decision about whether or when to make a report. That
Chairman,
refers to line 10, deleting and adding the rest of the line, and only after obtaining an authorization from the patient or the personal representative of the patient to disclose the information.
Representative,
can I ask a question on that? We've talked about this before. Yes. This really troubles me. Is there anything, if I'm a physician and I come in, walk in and observe a case of sexual abuse, I'll have to deal with it under the hospital policies, whatever they are. But is there anything that compels me to even ask the patient whether I should report it or not? I mean, if I decide I don't want to report this,
mm-hmm.
and I recognize I can't report it without prior consent, I can just go away and say, well, I was sure the patient didn't want me to report it. I didn't ask them, but I felt quite sure they didn't, and therefore I couldn't report it. I mean, this doesn't even compel me to ask for consent. to report it, does it?
Well, no, I think it would. You would have to ask.
Why? Where is there in the bill that says that? Or in the amendments? All it says is that I am not allowed to do it without having first obtained prior consent.
But it also,
I really support this bill. I want to make sure this happens. But this piece really, really makes me nervous. It provides an out.
Okay. Section 2. Any public or private official having reasonable cause to believe that a hospital patient with whom the official comes in contact with while acting in an official capacity has suffered abuse, or that a person with whom the official comes into contact has abused a patient in the hospital, shall report or cause a report to be made in the manner described in Section 3.
Only after obtaining an authorization.
But that's
a continuation of that sentence.
Right.
But there isn't anything that says I need to ask for an authorization. It says I shall report it only after I've received an authorization.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very clear that you would be required to attempt to get the authorization. Well, if you saw the abuse. The other one is there may very well be cases where it's impossible for the patient to give.
Mr. Chair, I suppose putting it on the record that that's the intent of this bill,
that would be helpful.
I mean, that may suffice, but I'd much rather have language that requires them at least to try and get that permission. But I suppose putting it on the record is may do that.
Mr. Chair. I need clarification, I guess. So if a doctor comes in and sees that a patient is being abused, they are not required to report it now? Am I right? Follow-up?
Wait a minute. I believe physicians are mandatory reporters at this point, aren't they?
Not if they're not an elder or a child. Oh, good. We have an attorney.
Okay.
Monday morning, though.
Good morning, Holly.
Yeah, my follow-up is, could someone, maybe Holly would be the right one, is to, I was under the impression that all physicians are required to report abuse, and that this, you know, this sounds to me like you have to get, the physician would have to get the patient's approval.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. Part of the reason I did this was that this issue, the issue of reporting and disclosure of information, can only be discussed within the context of HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. But let me answer your first mm-hmm. question first, if I might. We have mandatory reporting. Doctors are mandatory reporters of abuse of children, the elderly, and people with disabilities. But there is nothing that requires the reporting of abuse if it is disclosed or if it is observed in a situation other than for an individual other than one of those three groups of individuals: children, elderly, and people with disabilities. So if I was in the hospital, there's no mandatory reporting because at the moment I don't fit into any of those categories. The issue of disclosure, however, gets a little bit more complicated because of the federal HIPAA requirements, which are the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. And what HIPAA says, and one of the trickinesses of this area, is that a physician can only report if it's required by state or federal law, or if they have permission. And the HIPAA requirements have sort of brought into them the acknowledgement that we have mandatory child abuse reporting, that we have mandatory elder abuse reporting. In issues of other populations, they say that it has to either be with the permission of the patient to report to the cops or some other law enforcement agency, or if the state law mandates that they do so. And it's an arena in which there's tremendous, fluidity because of that balance between these are not people that by definition are considered vulnerable, and so do you report it with the person's permission or do you report it without the person's permission? And in this case, I think the policy decision was to report it with the to the law enforcement agency with the consent of the patient, which is one of the directives or options under the federal HIPAA requirements.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. This really troubles me because I can, and it's not because I watch television, because I don't have a television except here in Salem, and so I tend to watch some of these hospital shows. But it makes me wonder, what if someone in the hospital, in under drug treatment, for example, is not able to, you know, or is afraid that here hangs their IV drip, and the person saying, if you tell, I will put something in it that will silence you forever. And thus then they would not give consent to report if it's discovered. And,
I think
and
I saw that episode.
Yeah. I just made it up. But I guess that's what troubles me, is that what makes a person who isn't a child, an elder, or a person with disabilities not as important to have their abuse reported? Especially when they're in the hospital, and I believe when you're in the hospital, you are somewhat vulnerable.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, let me see if I can, from a policy perspective, put this in a context. I mean, there are policy decisions in this whole arena, and so it's why you guys are here. But allow me to kind of at least set the stage for you in some of this. I think there's two answers to your question. One is that when you look at the list of who are mandatory reporters under this, there is, of course, always the assumption that these public and private officials are not, in fact, the abuser. So from the get-go, now I'm not saying I agree or disagree, but from the get-go, somebody else discovers this information and has the obligation or the responsibility to report it. Now, I understand that there are going to be times when one of the official reporters is, in fact, in this case, also the abuser. But the intent is that there is an abuser and then there is a reporter, and they're not the same person. Now, I realize that that's not always going to be the case, but I think in terms of this universe, particularly if you look back to the 30 years that we've been doing child abuse reporting, the mandatory reporters were those that heard it, didn't necessarily, were not in that same position of reporting. So that is, it's important at least to go into this to assume that at the beginning, the reporters and the abusers are not the same person. Now, again, I don't want to make the claim that they're not always, but the intent is that one is a hearer of the information and reports it. The second reason is that, and again, this was these are policy perspectives, and I've become well-versed in this because the legislature is dealing with this issue on a number of fronts. You have groups of individuals that by characteristics are perceived to be more vulnerable. The elderly and the kids are two of those groups. People with disabilities are the third group. At some point, the legislature has made a policy decision that as an entire entity, an entire group, they are vulnerable. All elderly persons are vulnerable. All children are vulnerable. And that is a policy decision is one that the legislature can clearly make. When you get into groups of other individuals, if all of us were in the hospital, at what point do you want to define that entire group as being a vulnerable group? And again, I mean, there are no bright lines in this world, in this universe, but if you don't want to characterize an entire group of people, all patients in a hospital, as being vulnerable by virtue of the fact that they are physically in a hospital, which you can or you cannot do, but those are where the dividing lines are. And so as you try to define who a vulnerable group of people are, sometimes there are unintended consequences, but you have to just think through. I mean, we've made a policy decision that all kids, even if they're 17 and a half, are vulnerable. We've made a decision that all seniors are vulnerable, and some of them are sharper than I am. So when you take a group of people and you declare them for the purposes of an abuse reporting statute, then you have to decide from a policy perspective who you want to put in that category. The second reason that this conversation becomes important, and there's a bill on the Senate side that I suspect you'll see that has to do with nurses and reporting. There are two points of having reporting statutes, and I don't know if this point was been made because I didn't hear this earlier, but we have abuse reporting for two very separate and distinct reasons. One is to get involved and provide protective services and I use that in quotes, to the vulnerable person. If kids are being abused, you remove them, or you remove the perpetrator. If a senior is being abused, you provide protective services. That's one general reason for providing these kinds of reporting requirements. The second is to just begin tracking a problem to determine whether, in fact, there is a situation of abuse reporting. I mean, if there is a situation of abuse recurring, and how do you capture that data? To step away from this bill and work and talk about a bill on the Senate side that talks about reporting of violence against nurses, the intent there is to start developing a database and some information about how often, in fact, do these incidents occur. So part of, I think, the policy decisions behind that this bill raises is, or one of the policy reasons is, do you want to start creating a vehicle whereby somebody is beginning to collect the data that says in our hospitals people are reporting to law enforcement that these abuses are occurring, which is a totally separate reason, issue than does the person who was abused actually need protective services? And I think it's important in terms of the policy debate to distinguish between those two options. Do you want just a reporting mechanism so that you begin to accumulate the data? Or are you doing it to, in fact, provide protective services? I don't know. In the nurse reporting bill that has been introduced on the Senate, the intent clearly was to start creating a database that says nurses are attacked, you know, this many times in this period of time, and we need to begin to get a handle on this problem. Obviously, the intent in that case was not to give protective services to the nurses who were being abused. So again, I'm only trying to describe to you the policy decisions. I think part of the intent of this, and I don't want to speak for Representative Hansen, but being aware of the incident that drove it, part of it was, do we have a problem? A reporting requirement allows you to see whether or not you have, in fact, a problem in terms of incidents of abuse occurring in a hospital. Yeah, and I think it's important to just keep those two policy issues separate when you're deciding how to move forward.
I'll just a second. I want to ask
There's one other compelling reason for this too, is that the victim of abuse in this situation may not be aware that it has even occurred. Whereas in other cases, the victim usually knows that it has occurred and can take steps to correct the situation. But these people, besides the fact that they're vulnerable at the time the offense is occurring, they're also incapable of maybe even knowing that it has occurred, which is one of the other driving reasons for reporting.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe it is possible to define the population in a clear, bright line as being vulnerable, as it does in Section 1, Sub 1 of this Act. It specifically defines a patient as vulnerable to sexual attack, and I think that's a clear, bright line. I think we ought to stick to it. The question I have, Holly, is you said there were two things that would make this allowable under HIPAA. One would be a clear statute that requires it, and the other would be consent. Is it your sense, in this case as a counsel, in terms of the legal issue, that if we deleted what's the consent stuff, if we ended, I don't know whether what you have in front of you, but if we ended after 2005 Act, period, and in the original bill, line 20. Then would this meet the requirement of a state statute under HIPAA?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, no. In order to require disclosure, the may in line 19 would have to become a shall.
No, I'm sorry. That is the way I have it in my note.
Okay.
But if it was a shall, it would qualify under HIPAA without the authorization section.
Correct. Right. Those are your two choices most of the time under a HIPAA situation. You either, state law or some other law requires disclosure, or disclosure is allowable with consent.
So either way, it's going to meet the HIPAA requirement.
Correct.
I want to make sure that I understand. Thank you for asking that question. That's where I was going to. So if it is mandatory that if a medical professional discovers that there was abuse, then it would be, if we were to do as Representative Greenlit suggested, it would be required that they don't need to get the permission from the patient. We would be required by law to report it. Am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Under HIPAA, generally, medical providers have certain situations in which they can disclose information without the consent of the patient. And one of them is when state law makes them do it. It removes the authorization requirement because the provider or the healthcare professional, and the provider in this case, is compelled to provide certain information.
Thank you.
I just want to make sure.
Representative Boone had a follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just want to make sure I understand this because I can think of no other bad situation for us to be making policy as when someone's in the hospital and they don't feel safe and they feel either for some reason they can't give consent because they've been threatened or whatever, but to be in the hospital, to be under medical care, to have been violated and then feel that you can't give consent to have it be reported, I can't imagine why we are excluding a group of people from reporting because it sets a policy. It makes a statement that we think, well, abuse in this case, in this case, in this case is not right, but it's okay here unless they want us to report it. And it doesn't, in my opinion, make the statement that abuse is wrong whoever you do it to, and it should be reported, and particularly when you're in a vulnerable situation as being in the hospital, whether you're tied up to IVs or you're tied, you are vulnerable because you're in a room by yourself, mm-hmm. and you, whoever it is, has access to you. Maybe it's a charismatic physician, and that physician is responsible for your care. Maybe you're undergoing surgery the next day. I can't imagine the stress level that would be on a person knowing that this has been happening and this person is going to be cutting on them the next day. I mean, I'm taking it a little bit far maybe, but I don't like the idea if we're leaving a group out just because they're not a child or they're a person with a disability or they're an elderly person.
So it sounds, Representative, like we are moving to a different level with this bill. Do you have any problem with that?
Well, move to the level very carefully. And that's because this is a balancing thing. If an adult has been abused, they need to feel empowered to be able to make decisions about their life. And one of those decisions is whether or not they want their particular abuse to be reported, whether they consent to it or not. Now that's different than somebody that isn't capable of making that decision. And usually we claim that that minors or elderly or people that are severely disabled aren't in the position to be able to make that decision. But in the case of somebody who was temporarily disabled, temporarily incapacitated, abused in those circumstances, and then have found out that they were abused, we don't want to re-victimize them by saying, now that this abuse has occurred, now we are also requiring you to step forward and report it and take part in whatever the judiciary process is involving that case. And all of us, I think, would want a patient in those circumstances to go ahead and sign the consent and allow the process to move forward. But there may be some rare cases where the patient doesn't want that. And in those cases, I would want to honor that patient's decision. And it's obviously a difficult a difficult balancing act for all of us.
Mr. Chairman,
I think though that in that case, even in terms of the prosecutors and stuff, and this may apply in a lot of sexual abuse cases, if the victim isn't willing to move the case forward, oftentimes the case and that's unfortunate, but I think it's a reality of the situation.
Okay, Representative Greenlee, and then after that, we're going to have to wrap this up and do a little bit more work on this bill apart from this work session. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Yes, the issue here, I think, is when that abuse is reported. And it seems to me under the context of this bill, if I see something happening as a public official, whatever it's defined here, while the patient's in the hospital, I need to report it right then, when the patient is vulnerable and not necessarily able to give consent. I think you're right. If something emerges 3 months after I get out of the hospital and there's an investigation, then my rights are very different. But I think the intent of this is to get it reported while the patient remains in the hospital. Yeah.
To certainly get it reported and get it reported immediately.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to order an amendment to allow us to debate it that would take out the consent process from here. If that meets your needs, if we're going to bring it back up again for a work session. I'd like to have both alternatives in front of us.
I think what I'll ask is for a small group to get together to work through some of these issues.
Excellent.
And
thank you.
Love if you would participate in your busy schedule. And then we'll decide how we'll go. Does that work for you, Representative?
That work?
Representative Butler.
One other question that I had that we didn't get to, and that was on page 2, the issue of retaliation. I'm concerned that be addressed as well, because if there is not either a body of law or some history relative to retaliation and the definition of retaliation, I mean, almost anybody who reports and is involved in this probably feel like they're being retaliated if they don't get a paycheck increase the next time they see their paycheck. So I just like something, some identification.
Whistleblower protection.
Right. What the level of retaliation or what retaliation means in the law as to these folks that might be involved in that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to be on that committee, if I may.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Representative Boone. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Hansen.
You.
We'll get to this, Representative Hansen. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2480. Close the work session on House Bill 2351. And is Bruce Anderson outside?
He's sitting there.
Okay, good. We will open the...
He's lurking.
Bruce doesn't lurk. Come on. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2800.
Hanging out with another Bruce.
Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2800. We had a public hearing the first part of April 4th. This is the bill that looks at modifying and changing the mandatory overtime rules for the nurses. Licensed practical nurses or certified nursing assistants requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules on the staffing levels for specified hospital care units. We had some concerns raised at that public hearing. You should have in front of you the -3 amendments dated April 26th with a hand engrossed version of those amendments.
Okay. House Bill 2800.
2800.
I'll let you decide who's going to bring us up to speed.
Okay, Mr. Chair, for the record, Bruce Anderson with House Speaker Karen Menes' office. Hearing before you today in support of House Bill 2800 and the -3 amendments before you. Appreciate the committee's indulgence and help and assistance on this. After the last hearing on this, we sat down with the Oregon Nurses Association, SEIU, AFSCME, the State Hospital, and the Hospitals Association, and pretty much what you have before you, I believe, is a result of that meeting. Came across some general understandings, I think, on some things. There was an issue, as you may recall, raised regarding the state hospital, and it was generally felt, if I'm not mistaken, and if I am, just ask anyone to correct me if I am wrong, that existing language would be able to address some of the issues that were brought as regards the Oregon State Hospital, thinking that what we're attempting to address in this bill is really related to nurse overtime and or nurse staffing, excuse me, and overtime, and that a broader issue relating to the state hospital would be is not what this bill is about. So we'll just ask for your support for that and turn it over to Mrs. King to talk more on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Susan King, the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. As Mr. Anderson said, what you have before you in the Dash 3 amendments represent a collaborative effort. You first saw much of this language in the Dash 1 amendments that were brought to you during the first hearing. And those Dash 1 amendments were developed between the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and the Oregon Nurses Association. Subsequent to that hearing, we did meet with all of the stakeholders regarding some of the issues that were brought up around the fiscal and feasibility impact, particularly for the state hospital, of meeting the mandatory overtime limitations and the process for initiating a discussion about diverting or holding admissions. What I have passed out to you is the existing law. Hopefully all of your copies have been highlighted quickly this morning. It was our understanding at the conclusion of the stakeholders meeting that two sections of existing law, in addition to the amendments brought forward to you today, meet the concerns of the state hospital regarding their ability to meet the limits of mandatory overtime and the question of diverting. And those sections of current law are 441-164 and 441-166, item 3C. Both of those sections allow for a hospital, if it has, in the case of mandatory overtime, if it has exhausted all of its available resources, that is on-call staff, existing working staff, it can impose mandatory overtime to meet the care needs of the patient. So that current flexibility exists in law. In 441-164, there has always been a process for a facility to apply to the, I'm going to give them the wrong name, State Health Division. Unfortunately, that name is going to be stuck in my brain forever. To apply to the State Health Division for a waiver if they are unable to meet portions of the current or envisioned future staffing regulations for the state. So there is a process. It would be evaluated by the state agency. And, again, it was our understanding that those two eventualities met both the fiscal impact concerns as well as the feasibility concerns of the state hospital.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and here to endorse the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2800. As Susan King testified, we worked collaboratively with the Oregon Nurses Association to come forward with these amendments and think that the Dash 3 amendments are a reasonable compromise of the interests of hospitals, nurses, and others in this area. I just want to register for the committee's information that there is one outstanding concern. It's one with which Susan will disagree. She thinks it's not an issue. We don't know if it's an issue or not, but legal counsel for a hospital system has raised a question about the legality of the staffing committees under the National Labor Relations Act. This comes out of an opinion that the Attorney General issued about 5 years ago, before House Bill 2800 was passed in 2001. So if this is a problem, it's been a problem for several years. We don't know what the opinion of the Attorney General is about this bill and whether or not there are legal problems with this bill. I think there's going to be an effort to have that addressed. We don't believe that that should interfere with your consideration and adoption of this bill, but there is potentially another issue that that could affect the ability to implement this legislation should it become law. And I just wanted the committee to be aware of that in case it comes up in the future. Thank you very much.
Always something else. President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify, and I believe I know the answer, but I need it on the record with both Susan and Bruce, that this will not in any way damage or harm those small hospitals that don't have the ability to be flexible or as flexible, perhaps, as larger hospitals with larger nursing staffs available.
That, Bruce.
Chair Galto and Representative Butler, if I'm understanding what you're wanting to ensure is that all of the sections would be applied in a manner reasonable for the facility. So, for example, if the health division was entertaining a waiver from a small rural hospital, the conditions that exist in that local community and not in a community of a large urban hospital would be considered in a reasonable decision made. And it's our belief and our experience that that is the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we think that there could be problems in implementing this law for small hospitals, but there can also be problems for large hospitals that have specialized units that require very specialized staffing. Yes, there will be some difficulties. This isn't just a, you know, by your leave kind of thing that everybody can ignore, but there will not be specific problems for small hospitals vis-a-vis large hospitals, and there is sufficient flexibility, we believe, in the language to allow for adjustment for those local conditions to be satisfied.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Mr. Dalto, or Chair Dalto, if I could, I want to just thank Susan King and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Systems for working collaboratively together. I also want to thank Representative Tomei, SEIU and AFSCME and others for coming forward and working on this to move this forward. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, thank you for bridging all the concerns and putting this together. I know it was a lot of work.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Okay. I will, with that, entertain a motion on the -3 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves the -3 amendments to House Bill 2800. Is there any discussion? Any objection? -3 amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2800 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei, thank you very much. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2800 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I intend to vote yes, but I reserve the right to change my vote on the floor. I need to be in consultation with my rural hospitals, and those of us who have rural hospitals probably all ought to do the same kind of thing, because I'm always anxious when we set a whole set of rules together that might be beneficial for those places where you have virtually thousands of nursing staff available. But while we're out in Harney County and we're expected to take care of those ills and those issues of folks that are damaged on our highways or on our byways enjoying the beautiful scenery and so forth, we just don't have that kind of flexibility, and I appreciate the good work of the folks that have worked on this.
All right. Any other discussion or comments? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Is this on the amendments or the bill, Mr.
This is on the bill. We voted the amendments in already.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye. House Bill 2800, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Chair will carry the bill. With that, the work session on we'll close the work session on House Bill 2800 and reopen the work session on House Bill 2202. And they invite Mickey Lansing forward. And Randy Franke and Dean Lassiter. All right, we can do this in just a few moments, I should hope. So, Jean, go ahead.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, once again, I'm Jean Lassiter, and I'm here representing the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition, and I have checked with Mickey Lansing from the Oregon Commission on Children and Families regarding the amendments to House Bill 2202, and I ask that she can speak for herself about how she's responding.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Lansing, Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Due to the work of the small work group, the Partners for Children and Families, at their last month's meeting, looked at this particular piece of legislation, asked that we make some changes and bring it back to the coalition, which we did, and those changes are reflected in your amendments. So to let you know that Partners for Children and Families, which isn't an official name by statute, but is what we call ourselves and encompasses all of those agencies you see listed in Section 2, Sub 2, has agreed to do this work within our existing resources. I will, however, call your attention to Section 3, where it says the State Commission on Children and Families shall coordinate the collection of data, provision of technical assistance, et cetera, et cetera. We will do everything that we normally do in collecting data from the plan updates from the counties. We just want to ensure that the counties do not have an extra workload and that we at the commission office do not have an extra workload. But because we do this coordination anyway, Partners for Children and Families agreed to look at this particular issue and in fact to look at an additional high level outcome. I'm available for any questions.
So it sounds to me like a zero fiscal impact statement from you. Is that right?
Chair Dalto, that is correct as right. long as...
No, no, stop right there. Go ahead. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just did want to confirm that that under Section 2, Part 3, that you've got a list of six items that you're going to have to accomplish. Which require both recommending, identifying, developing, policy development, review existing state laws and statutes, and then integrating systems. And so that under Section 3, and you pointed this out, Nikki, that in the process of coordinating the collection of the data and provision of technical assistance, that requires no additional staff. And number two, that under Section 5, that local commissions on children and family shall consider the needs, resources, and the support, and as part of the process, it indicates the local commission shall provide information to the state commission, that they will be able to do that with enhanced funding that you're providing or with the existing funding that you're providing.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, with existing funding. With existing funding as it exists today, because in fact what you see in Section 5 is part currently of their update process on different areas. All this is asking them to do is just to address this particular population.
And so they have the resources to do it locally now. And is there a roll-up in any of the funding locally? And this, I haven't seen the...
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler. Initially, when Senate Bill 555 was passed in 1999, that created the Partners for Children and Families process and expanded the role of local commissions in their planning for service delivery. That first biennium, based upon 1 year, because it phased in, they got $600,000 to do additional planning. In the second biennium, in 01, they got $1.2 million to do the planning. That has been part of their roll-up. I might say the State Commission got zero. We at the state level got no additional dollars to do our coordination work. We do that because it was a policy issue, and in fact, it's the right thing to do. And so the way we do our work is to work together to see how we can better support what happens at the local level. How do we break down those barriers? What are the policies we need to change? What are the needs of kids and families in communities that have an impact on our budget development and our policy?
So last question is just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So I just need to confirm that with regard to Section 3, State Commission on Children and Families shall coordinate the collection of data and the provision of technical assistance to the communities for assessing the needs of runaway and homeless, identifying and promoting the best practices. It requires no new additional staff. You're not going to have new additional staff to do any of this.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, what we're saying is in Section 3, and we will do everything we normally do now. We will not take on an additional workload to do this. So to the degree that it is done now in the collection of data, that's what we will do. We already do best practices all along the
But it requires additional workload. My question is, what are the staff needs? Are you adding new staff to do this?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, no, we are not.
Thank you.
Mr. Manchin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On 3B, line 2 of page 2, understand gender-specific and evidence-based and the urban-rural. Could you explain for me what culturally competent is?
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson. Culturally competent means that, in fact, and I'm not sure that any of us ever become culturally competent, it is something we are always working towards. How is it that we address the needs of different populations, whether it be race, ethnicity, class, sexual orientation, whatever that may be? How is it that we do that? And we include that in our best practices.
Thank you.
Okay, Randy, clean up at all?
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, thank you. Randy Franke, representing the Coalition of County Children and Family Commissions. We've been monitoring this bill. I think we're satisfied with the amendments. From the very beginning, my members have supported in concept the issue of dealing with homeless and runaway. In fact, many of the local commissions are already involved in various studies and activities around this issue. They just wanted to be very cautious that a lot of new requirements were not added on to them in this bill, and I think we're satisfied that we can continue doing what we're doing and handle this as it comes to the community without a lot of extra work.
Excellent. Music to my ears. Thank you very much.
Chair Dalton?
Yes.
Jean. Members of the committee, I just want to add from a community perspective, which is my perspective, is that this bill has allowed our community providers to provide a voice of advocacy for these young people in the state, and you know, the work that has been done on this bill has been done collaboratively with community members, and I think that what this bill does is it gives us an opportunity to share the responsibility, and I understand the clarification that's needed with regard to the lack of addition, to not adding to the commission's workload. But what I want to say to you is we'll do it ourselves. you know, it's really about us being able to connect with the commission and to create a venue for speaking out for these young people and sharing in the responsibility for their care. So I appreciate you hearing this bill all along. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. It's just a magnificent, magnificent job that you did. And what impressed me most was your 6 a.m. meeting with Representative Butler. I do my best sleeping at 6 a.m., so you are committed. Yes.
I'd like to second that. You know, we followed this process through the interim, and it was, I think, quite extraordinary work, and I think the state is going to be better off for it, and I do appreciate it as well.
Great job. Okay, thanks very much. With that, I would entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendment, please.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2202. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 1 amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill House Bill 2202 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
That's as amended.
As amended, yes. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2202 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Chair.
Yes.
I still intend to check with my local commissions, and I do represent four very small counties in terms of size of population, but I appreciate the good work that Randy Frankie has done in bringing us along, and I think they're okay with this.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Dalto?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2202, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Cameron will be attached to carry this bill. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2202 and open a work session on House Bill 2480. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2480 comes before us again for a work session. We had a public hearing on this bill on March 11th. This is the bill that prohibits the Department of Human Services from limiting prescription drugs used for the treatment of hepatitis C, declares an emergency. It's effective on July 1, 2005. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that we have gotten approval to rescind that referral. There are no amendments, to my knowledge.
Okay, thank you very much. I believe this bill is ready to go as it stands. Good coalition of sponsors on this bill, so I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2480 to it's got a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Right, it's been rescinded.
It's been rescinded, so, and so I would move 2480 to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Judiciary be rescinded. Discussion? Representative Greenlake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be voting against this bill. I think it has, while I think the intentions are good, I think it creates some very serious potential problems. One potential problem is that it takes away the department's ability to create a best practices model that determines who should and who shouldn't get this very, very expensive drug. Anytime somebody gets this drug, it takes a year's drugs off of somebody else. It replaces that. And the second problem is that it also prevents the department, should there be a less expensive and more effective alternative coming to the floor, it prevents the department from using that less expensive and more effective alternative in a case where we're talking about thousands of dollars per case. And I just think it's I think it's very problematic.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Greenick, for your comments. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will also be voting no on this bill for the similar reasons to Representative Greenlee.
Okay, clerk, call roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
No.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair
Dalto? Chair votes aye. House Bill 2480, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Would somebody like to carry this bill? Seeing no volunteers.
I'll do it.
Debbie Boone. President Boone will carry. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2480. We will now...
Chair,
yes.
I'm going to consider the possibility of a minority report.
Okay.
Let you know. Thank you.
All right. we're not doing 2640.
It's more left.
No. Okay. We don't need 2640. With that, we will open a work session on House Bill 2754.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2754, and I think the SMS is right on this bill. We had a public hearing on April 13th. This is the bill that creates the Oregon Center for Health Professions within the Department of Higher Education, and it will be administered by the Oregon Institute of Technology. We don't have... Excuse me. We do have a dash one amendment which expands the list of health education programs. You should have the dash one amendment dated March 14th as well as a hand and growth bill. This too has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that we have gotten authorization to rescind that, and attached to today's SMS you should have, this is just kind of the day of double negatives here, a fiscal impact statement that says there is no impact. So we do have confirmation that this bill will not have a fiscal impact on it, but they do give some additional comments that the committee might be interested in.
Okay, you'll recall that this seems to be the direction the university system is going. The governor's office came and testified in support. Hospital systems came in to testify in support of this bill. Representative Garrard made a very strong case for it. With that, I'll entertain a motion on the dash one amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to be appended to House Bill 2754. Those are dated 3/14/05.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2754, dated March 14th, 05. Any discussion on the amendments? Any objections to the amendments? Amendments, the dash one amendments are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Inasmuch as the authorization is in hand to rescind the Ways and Means subsequent referral, I move House Bill 2754 as dash one amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2754 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Hammond.
Aye.
Representative
Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative
Butler.
Aye.
Chair Balto.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2754, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Garrard would be assigned to carry this bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2754. Open the work session on House Bill 3049. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3049. We heard last week, April 25th, this is directing the Department of Human Services to adopt rules under which a person with a developmental disability receiving medical assistance and residential services from DHS may retain earned income and remain eligible for services. Mr. Chair, we have Brian DeLashma and Catherine White here to update the committee on some outstanding questions that the committee had last time. They're reporting back.
Okay. Welcome. Where are we?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashmet representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. I know there was a number of questions last time, and I don't believe it was from lack of support for the concept, but it was concerns about does this somehow interfere with the state's ability to draw dollars? Is there some kind of penalty if they were to do certain things? I actually want to thank Catherine for doing a number of communications and contacts with people who are at a national level that did are very bright about this particular subject. She's got some information, and what I have in my memo here is Catherine's suggestions on how we could proceed without running afoul of federal law and losing some dollars. And with that, I will turn it over to Catherine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Catherine White from the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities and the DD Coalition. We had an opportunity this last week to talk to a number of people from around the country who happened to be in Oregon for a conference. And in terms of trying to make this as simple as possible, what the suggestion was that we put a high end in terms of amount of money, recognizing that the average amount that individuals actually earn, it's a rare exception that anyone would earn up to the $1,243 a month, but it would be consistent with other areas of our system where individuals receive SSI as opposed to SSDI. And so that the figure would run from $65 a month to the ability to retain $1,243 a month. One of the comments that was made is that there are many things that we currently pay for within our system because people do not have access to discretionary income. We do pay for all over-the-counter drugs for individuals. We pay for a lot of other expenses simply because people do not have money and are not allowed to use their earned income to pay for other expenses that they have. So this was the recommendation that we thought was the simplest. We also recommended that there be some benefits planning done with individuals because the federal government has recognized this as an issue for people with disabilities. There are programs that would allow people to save some money and to purchase things that would increase their independence and productivity. So that's why we added the recommendation that they be allowed to have some benefits counseling and that be incorporated in other types of training that the department provides, both for staff and individuals.
With that, Mr. Chair, I think what we're seeking is direction from the committee. If you want us to go away, use this as the template for amendments, we'll go down, march down there, get them drafted, and come back to you and on to Ways and Means.
Well, I don't want the issue to go away, so go get your amendments, I suppose. President Butler?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure we're still dealing with 600 or fewer employees here that are involved in this. And this would create, in effect, a blanket exemption of up to $1,243, nearly $15,000 a year. Is that the minimum wage? Is that what that is, the $1,243?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't believe that would address the minimum wage. It would be the maximum amount an individual could retain. Now, there are other factors that will come into effect in terms of people's ability to hold income. In other words, the Medicaid has caps on the amount of mm-hmm. money an individual is able to retain.
Where does that kick in, if I could ask?
The maximum amount for someone that is employed, the maximum amount would be $12,000 a year.
So I guess I'm looking at it.
So you
$55 to $1,243, why it wouldn't be $65 to $1,000?
I think that, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, what this would allow is and would require that an individual use some of this money to pay for things that, frankly, are currently paid for by the state. In other words, they wouldn't be keeping this total amount as discretionary income, but would, in fact, be using this money for paying for the kind of expenses that we pay for, clothing, medications, that sort of thing, that are currently paid for out of other pots of money within the state.
So in that regard, what it does is it makes that money available for them to provide for their own independence and for their purchases of those items, offsetting what we would be expending out of the DHS budget for these same folks. So in that regard, even though we're dealing with 600 people, which we were talking about less than $30,000 before, we might be talking about well over $30,000, but the net effect of it is still that they are buying the items that we use to purchase for them. So there isn't a fiscal cost greater than the $30,000 we were previously looking at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that is what we have been told has been the experience in some of the other states. Now, if you remember correctly, the state said if we ignore all earned income, that they estimated the cost to be $690,000 total. That is the amount of money that currently comes into the state that would not come into the state, and that's a biennial figure. We're estimating that there will be some offsets on that money and that the total fiscal impact would not be that great.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, as you recall, there has been some discussion around whether that fiscal was real in a real world an accurate fiscal, because with the disincentives to work now, you have people that are not opting into working, and you would be generating some additional income into the state if we had an encouragement or a disincentive for people to not work. So we believe that fiscal actually is vastly reduced.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate while Brian and Catherine are working on this, that they would at least check with our Ways and Means Human Services Chair in the House to at least discuss how this might be affected, because I know that he has been working on these kinds of programs to develop independence and those kinds of things, and see if we can't maybe massage this with more legalistic approach. I think it might be a workable deal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, surprised that you should suggest that. I've already had that discussion.
Wonderful.
And I've had that discussion with other members of the committee, and as was the reaction of this committee, they were not aware that we had this kind of disincentive. He was very encouraging to me that he would like to look at this issue and encourage those people to earn income and have some independence.
You bet. Thank you, Ryan. I think that's very important that we try and incentivize them to work, and I appreciate your proactivity in working with that chair.
We will go away and get amendments to come back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3049 and open a work session on House Bill 3219. Jim Davis, Bill Koss, Jane Myers.
Here's a dash warning, Mr. Chair, that we got back this morning.
Colleagues, this is the reciprocal licensure for dentist bill. It's been worked on quite a bit, various interested parties. So, good morning, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Denturist Association and various senior citizen organizations. We have worked with Jane Myers and Joe Koss being chair of the State Board of Denture Technology, and Jane Myers of the Oregon Dental Association, and we have come to agreement on the Dash 1 amendments that were recommended by ODA. We have no problem with the addition of 3,500 hours in a five-year period, and also the insertion of practical and written examination. As you can see, the practical and written examination is on line 14. It's just added to that aspect that an applicant would have to have passed a written and practical examination, and then there is a new subsection 4 added, that this individual will have to have engaged in active practice of denture technology for no fewer than 3,500 hours in a five-year period immediately preceding the date of their application for licensure. So we are in agreement, and I think the bill is ready to move, Mr. Chair.
All right, Jane, you happy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers for the Oregon Dental Association. A little weak in the voice this morning, but we worked with the Oregon Denturist Association on this, and we're fine with the amendment.
Great. Thank you for working with the denturists. Okay, thanks very much. Okay. President Butler?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing this back again. I appreciate the good work. I think this is demonstrative of the fact that when good people can get together, they can agree. And with that, I would move the dash one amendments be appended to House Bill 3219.
I'm sorry, did you move the dash one amendments?
Dash one.
Thank you. President Butler moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3219. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? The dash one amendments are ordered adopted. President Butler, or Representative Anderson, yes?
Yeah, I move the House Bill 3219 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves House Bill 3219 to the House floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative
Greenwood? Aye.
President Butler?
Aye.
Chair Balto?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3219, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Do I have a carrier?
I'd be willing to carry this, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Why wouldn't Representative Anderson?
He didn't pipe up, so.
That's fine. Do you want to?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson will carry the bill. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3219. Committee, just give us a moment, please.
We requested this in, and we didn't get it back. This is a lot of it here.
Should drop up our schedule.
Wednesday's. Let's do it. Okay. I'm just hanging on to it until we get to this. Can you see that?
Okay. All right, with that, we will open the work session on House Bill 3230.
Sandy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3230 is relating to the deaf and hard of hearing being moved from the Oregon Disabilities Commission to the Department of Human Services. We received a lot of testimony on April 6th. This bill has been amended. You should have the dash twos in front of you. This is basically a gut and stuff amendment. What it has done, and it also has addressed removing the fiscal. If you recall, the original bill had 35 cent, I believe it was section 11 in the original bill. It was asking that 5 cents of a 35 cent per month surcharge be used by the office for services to the deaf and hard of hearing. That has been removed in the dash 2 amendment. This is basically the organizational structure of what the, I'm drawing a blank, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Office functions, duties, the program development. It appoints, it authorizes the director to appoint an advisory committee of 12 individuals. The program, it also then outlines the program functions. This is a fairly recent amendment. People has not had a chance to look at it. We have submitted, because the actual fiscal impact language has been removed, we have submitted a letter asking that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded, so this will go directly to the floor.
Okay. Colleagues, do you all have the dash two amendments?
I do not.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It should be on the very, on the back.
Okay.
So the bottom of your stack from today.
Thank you.
God, this is a good bill. It's ready to go. I'll allow a moment here for Representative Butler to take a look at the dash twos if he wants.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm still unclear. I'm are you wanting to do a work session vote on this?
Well, the deal is, Representative March is, I believe, in the Committee on Ways and Means, just down the hall.
Here.
Oh, he's right there. Mm-hmm. Representative March, come forward, please. This bill is ready to go. We just need to adopt the dash two amendments. It has a subsequent referral. The dash twos take out the fiscal impact Representative Marsh can speak to that. We have not yet received the approval, but I'd like to get this going and hang on to the bill in committee until we get the approval, because I'd like to get it off our plate. Representative Marsh, do you want to explain how this removes the fiscal and also answer any questions Representative Tomei has?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. The Dash 2 amendments completely gut the bill, basically. It makes it a new bill. The new bill transfers the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program over to DHS for their responsibility.
And where it's
currently in the Oregon Disabilities Commission. That commission has not been funded. It's also an advocacy commission. This takes the program that is the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program and puts it with services where it belongs and allows the ODC to continue on as an advocacy commission if they get funded. And that's up to, of course, the Ways and Means process. The previous version of this bill referenced a telecommunications charge that's under PUC. This version completely eliminates any reference to that at all, and it only takes the existing contracts that the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program is funded by and transfers those to DHS. So it's totally other funds. There's no change in the program at all under this. What it does do, it puts into statute the advisory commission that's currently being advising the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program. It does give it a name, the Oregon Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. It doesn't create an executive officer. So in essence, it just slides the existing program over and puts in statute how it's currently operated. It does remove one reference to certification because power in the existing statute is no longer being used. So it cleans up the existing statutes in that way. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Questions?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I still am a little unclear. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine.
Because this is the first time I've seen these two amendments.
Right.
So why was it important to take this office from the Disabilities Commission and putting it into the Department of Human Services?
Currently, the Disabilities Commission, let's back up to the 03 session. Prior to the 03 session, the Disabilities Commission was receiving some general funds, general fund, to fund its operation. In the 03 session, we cut back all of the Advocacy Commission's general fund dollars. We told all of those Advocacy Commissions to find their own funding. In the meantime, the Oregon Disabilities Commission was given a one-time permission to use some of the funds contracted for by other agencies for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services to be used for administrative purposes for the operation of Oregon Disabilities Commission. The governor did not come up with any additional general fund money, and so the Disabilities Commission was planning to continue to use funds that are contracted for services for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing for administrative purposes. And this clarifies that no, we want the services to continue, and the proper place is in a place like DHS, where they have currently the administrative overhead to handle and operate such a program, and they are the biggest contractor for these services. So they, in essence, be contracting with themselves for these types of services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Butler.
Inasmuch as we have Representative March here, and this is a unique opportunity to ask because of your Ways and Means work that you're doing, Representative, is the amount of money that's specified for the telecommunications services retail subscriber surcharge, which is presently authorized, is it not enough? Is it not sufficient?
This program gets zero funding from the PUC dollars. Under the original version of the bill, we were proposing to use 5 cents for an expanded service center model of delivering services to the deaf and hard of hearing beyond what the Access program does, which is provide ASL language interpreters for deaf and hard of hearing working with state agencies.
Clarification, Mr. Chair. So the amount of resources that are presently being collected are just sufficient for that one and not for administrative purposes?
One function. None of the current PUC monies are being used for this program. They are only being used currently for what they call the TDAP program, and that's for equipment and telephone relay type services. So they were not being used for this program. We were proposing to use some of those monies. There's authorized up to 35 cents currently. They're using 10 cents. We had proposed using some of that. In fact, there is a Senate bill that is in Ways and Means for that purpose. I'm currently talking with the telecommunication providers to find out if maybe we could do a pilot project of a limited duration with a much less money under Senate Bill 1005. But this program does not currently receive any of those monies and will not receive any of those monies in this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Boone.
And DHS agrees to do this?
Yes. In fact, the governor had proposed moving the Disabilities Commission to DHS, and that may still go through. I don't know. That's another item that this bill doesn't contemplate. This bill just says these services, since they're services, they belong in DHS, and they will operate just as they've been operating currently. So we're just moving them from one commission that's underfunded and very small and unable to sort of take on this extra responsibility under the current budget situation, and moving them to DHS, which is a large organization and has the capability.
All right, Representative Marks, just one last time to be clear on the record. No fiscal?
No fiscal. It's just a shift of the program over and puts in statute the advisory committee that is currently operating. There is no additional funding in this bill whatsoever.
Okay.
Under the dash dues.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Let me just ask this question as much as you've raised it again. The direction of the governor had been to seek out funding from other resources and to basically run their own operation. As I understand, there's no new fiscal resource being provided. DHS agrees to this and is willing to work within the administration of the current deaf and the hard of hearing program.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Marks.
Thank you.
May I have a motion on the dash twos?
Yes. I move the dash two amendment to appended to House 3230.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3230. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the dash two amendments are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair, do you need to seek any additional authorization for the removal of the fiscal and the rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Representative Butler, I have made the request. Our requests are most of the time granted customarily, and I would like to move this thing and get it on its way. And
Mr. Chair, in accordance with your request, then I move House Bill 3230 as amended with the dash two amendments be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. I appreciate that. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any objection? Speak now or for an older piece, I guess. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Butler votes aye.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3230, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative March is attached as a carrier. Colleagues, thank you very much. We'll close the work session, House Bill 3230. Did a lot of work today. I appreciate all your input. And with no other business coming before the committee, this committee is adjourned.
You sure you want to stay?